Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The lawn goes along with the lawnmower, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a chance to gouge your foot or knock out an eye and pollute the atmosphere and disturb the peace and look like a fool wrestling around with this device. How crazy is that?
Peter Bain makes a pretty compelling case for ripping out your lawn and planting edibles instead. He'll be with us to talk about permaculture. Salem and Jonas of Bread and Roses Gardens let us observe them as they lay down some sheet mulch. Another story from Harvest Public Media about food terrorism and specifically how the dairy industry is impacted by new FDA regulations. And one epic recipe with Chef Bob Adkins today. Ever had lamb ribs? Well, that's what he's cooking up. The latest in food news with Lou Ann Johnson.
First, Annie, some backstory. In December last year, the FDA introduced a set of voluntary guidelines touted as a crackdown on non-medical use of antibiotics. The move was meant to address concerns about rising antibiotic resistance in bacteria that poses a health threat to people. Livestock on conventional farms are often given low doses of antibiotics that, as a side effect, add extra pounds to animals before slaughter. The FDA's new rules ask drug makers to advise against growth promotion on their label instructions, effectively barring the use of those antibiotics for fattening. The organization Food and Water Watch took a close look at the labels for antibiotics used to promote growth and found that 89% could still be given to healthy animals for other reasons. According to Sarah Boron, a researcher with the group who led the project, only 23 out of 217 growth-promoting drugs have been completely removed for purposes other than treating sick animals. During a Senate hearing last week, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren told FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg that the new guidelines were a good step, but failed to guarantee that farmers wouldn't keep using the drugs for the wrong reasons. According to Warren, quote, "If we continue to use 30 million pounds of antibiotics in food animals every year, which is about four times as much as we use in people, we're likely to have a lot more resistant infections and fewer antibiotics that work when we need them," unquote. And a group of lawyers is waging a campaign to force food companies to pony up for their share of the financial burden obesity costs taxpayers. The campaign has been compared to the fight against tobacco companies that resulted in massive settlements for states in the mid-1990s. But analysts and food industry reps say that comparison is broken. While tobacco lawsuits were aimed at a limited field of four top manufacturers in the industry, food companies form a much broader target, with many more producers in play. And though some research supports the possibility of behavioral addiction to food ingredients like sugar, salt, and fat, the science isn't settled. Stephen Gardner, the director of litigation for the Center for Science in the Public Interest and a longtime consumer advocate, also sees big stumbling blocks ahead. Though he emphatically agrees that the food industry bears responsibility for skyrocketing obesity, he's concerned that filing such a lawsuit too early could even do more harm than good. He said, quote, "Not bringing a case is better than bringing a case, losing it, and setting a bad rule of law that the next case has to fight against," unquote. Thanks to Chad Bouchard for these stories. Read even more food news at eartheats.org.
We post news like this as soon as we hear it on our Twitter feed. Follow us at Earth Eats. Lou Ann Johnson with our headlines. Much appreciated.
You got it.
The Food and Drug Administration is establishing regulations aimed at protecting the U.S. food supply from terrorist acts. Last week, we explored some of the reasons why lawmakers view food terrorism as such a significant threat. Today, we look at the agency's proposed remedy, which would require the nation's largest food manufacturing plants to tighten up security. Harvest Public Media's Abby Fentress-Swanson examines the potential impact on the dairy industry, which is considered the most vulnerable to attack.
It's about 9 in the morning at the University of Missouri in Columbia, and this cafeteria is buzzing. Students carrying backpacks line up for omelets or biscuits and gravy, and there's a crowd at the self-serve milk station. Students fill glasses with chocolate milk, pour skim milk over cereal, or splash 2% into coffee. University Purchasing Coordinator Sandy Purley says milk is extremely popular here.
Our entire campus in a year drinks about 96,000 gallons of milk. And by our best calculation, that's about 326 gallons a day.
All that milk goes through many steps, cow, bottling plant, delivery, before reaching the cafeteria. Should a toxin be injected somewhere along the supply chain, experts believe it could have devastating human health and economic consequences. The FDA's proposed regulation to deal with that threat would force food manufacturing plants with over $10 million in annual sales to develop food defense plans, things like locking gates when they're not in use, maintaining visitor logs, and opening mail and rooms separate from production areas.
Milk is a short shelf life product, and so it gets distributed very quickly and consumed very quickly. It's also produced in very large batches.
Don Kramer is senior advisor at the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. He says the agency is especially concerned about plants that process large volumes of liquid.
Storage of fluids, liquids. That's a key activity type because it's a situation where an agent can be added, a toxin could be added to the food, and it would tend to be fairly easily mixed into the food as opposed to stay in a clump somewhere that isn't going to be dispersed into a large volume of food and cause massive casualties, which is what we believe a terrorist organization would want to do.
But it's not just dairy. All but the smallest food manufacturing, processing, and storage facilities registered with the FDA would be covered by the regulation. Manufacturing plants abroad that export food to the U.S. would also have to comply. The agency estimates the rule will affect about 4,600 food production firms and that it will cost them $370 million annually.
It's a large group of industry that needs to look at this rule, really provide thoughtful comment because it will affect them.
Amy Kircher is director of the National Center for Food Protection and Defense. She's gotten requests from companies that want to know how to comply with the rule.
It may be challenging for some companies or industries who've not thought about the defense of the food system from an intentional attack, but I would argue most people have considered it if they haven't yet put mitigation steps in place.
Both the FDA and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which regulates meat, poultry, and eggs, have been helping companies write food defense plans since 9/11. Highland Dairy, which sells milk and ice cream in the Midwest, took up the issue 12 years ago, says spokesman Greg Stevenson.
Since 2002, we've done so many things with all of our food production plants. This includes having all doors that have security padlocks on them that only employees know to get in. I've seen a lot of fencing that's gone up, especially around our ammonia tanks, with razor wire around the top of that.
Another big Missouri milk processor, Central Dairy, has seals on each of its trucks. If the seals are broken, the company knows something is wrong. Trucks like this one transporting products to multiple locations on the University of Missouri campus have several locks that prevent ice cream and milk from being tampered with, a delivery man explained.
I have these locks on here. That's the freezer.
The milk is kept behind a door secured with 3-inch long padlocks.
We use these padlocks for the back doors. Just like that. And we lock them and I have a key to it.
Many companies have taken steps to protect their operations from intentional contamination. Still, the FDA believes its rule is necessary because it would standardize food terrorism policy across industries. But back at University of Missouri Dining Services, Sandy Purley questions the necessity of the rule.
I think for me, I have concerns about whether it would increase cost to us because this is a big part of our budget, our food budget. And, you know, usually extra regulation does increase cost.
Right, cost. So far, that's a big issue for many companies weighing in during the FDA's comment period, which closes at the end of this month. They see the need for food defense plans, but want flexibility to reduce costs of implementation. Abby Fentress Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. We're at this weird time of year where you probably still have the heat on in your house, but your grill outside is starting to call your name. So we asked Chef Bob Adkins to come up with a recipe for us that fits the season. It's a warm weather classic, ribs, that you make in the oven. We visited Adkins in the kitchen at The Rail, where he is the executive chef. What does he have for us? Not pork ribs or even beef ribs.
But lamb ribs are kind of a little-known delicacy, I believe. They are a little temperamental to work with. They're very fragile, actually. There's not a lot of meat on there. There's quite a bit of fat. And so finding the best way to balance the amount of fat that remains after, because it's luscious and it's voluptuous and it feels good on the mouth and it tastes amazing. But also counterbalancing that with the little bit amount of meat. And so I've found the best way to approach small racks such as lamb ribs or extremely small baby back ribs is a semi-dry roast. So there's two schools of thought in ribs. There's the dry roasting or smoking, which is not using any liquid at all. There's also the braising or the steaming of the ribs before you finish them on a grill. This kind of incorporates the best of both worlds. We are utilizing our oven, putting the ribs out on a single sheet to roast them, but also we are regulating the moisture that is in that oven by a little bit of beer and a little bit of water, which keeps them moist and does some steaming as well as roasting. Lamb ribs aren't easy to find. You may be able to find them locally, but chances are you're only going to be able to get maybe a rack or two, which is fine. But they're small. It's about half the size of what a baby back rack of ribs would be. And they're also fairly expensive. So just like with most lamb, you really want to get the most flavor, the most finished product out of them that you can. And this process, this technique really concentrates the flavor while keeping the integrity and the shape and the good look of ribs when they're finished and falling off the bone. We work with what we get from our purveyors. So sometimes the ribs are a little bit smaller, sometimes they're a little fattier, sometimes they're a little this and this. So what we're doing back here is we're trying to achieve a consistent product with an inconsistent product that we get. I think the biggest thing that we've got is that they are delicious, but there is just a small amount there. But they really intensely lamb flavored. We pair them with just some simply roasted herb potatoes that we toss with leeks. So some nice mild flavors there. And then we top it with preserved Meyer lemons. And that's going to give a really nice acidity to cut some of that fattiness or some of that richness that goes along with it. Okay, so we have ribs. What we're going to do is we're going to rub these down. I'm going to move over to one of my favorite machines in the kitchen, the Vitamix. If anybody's out there, it's a shameless plug for the Vitamix.
It's a blender.
It is a blender.
Into it's this. Labeled Chef Bob's Baby, so you're not joking around that this is your favorite machine?
This machine is top of the line. It's a workhorse. There's only two switches. It's easy to clean. I can't say enough about this, and it truly is my baby, and I use it a lot.
We'll check back with Chef Bob Adkins and his Vitamix in the second half of the show. If you just can't wait, go to our website for the complete recipe and a slew of awesome photos of Adkins making the dish at eartheats.org. Peter Bain's book, The Permaculture Handbook, Garden Farming for Town and Country, starts off with the question, who am I to farm? His answer, well, anyone and everyone. 7 years ago, he transformed his front lawn into a permaculture paradise. To the untrained eye, it looks like a mess of greenery. But he says this is what it looks like to work with nature, not against it. So, who am I to farm? Perhaps the better questions, Bain says, are how can you rebuild your home economy? How can you be more self-reliant?
And how can you reduce your family's food budget? And being more engaged with your landscape and your neighbors and help take care of the earth, really. I mean, growing things in it in a way that builds soil, supports wildlife, enhances the capture of carbon out of the atmosphere.
I've never quite gotten a good explanation of what permaculture is in terms of how it's different from just plain old gardening.
I can understand that. The word comes from two terms that have been made into a coinage called permanent agriculture. Sometimes we also understand it to be permanent culture because it's all the things around agriculture that make farming and gardening work. But permaculture is a design system that's based on the laws of nature, the rules of ecosystems, so that we can build homes, gardens, neighborhoods, towns, countrysides that operate ecologically, that harvest energy and water, that purify wastes, that build soil, that ramify biodiversity, and at the same time feed people, clothe people, house them, and meet their energy needs.
I'm looking at the pictures in your book. There's a couple sections of color photos that are really beautiful. Renaissance Farm, that's
yes,
the name of the land.
Our place.
What it looks like you started with is a typical American setup, huge lawn in the front, and then these after pictures, if you will. It really looks like chaos. If you can describe how you went from typical American lawn to what looks like a forest.
We did it in stages. We were 7 years into our settlement there, and we started out, as you note, with lots of grass and a few trees and two modest little 1950s buildings. We spent a lot of time repairing the housing. It was very bad, very inefficient. And then we moved into the landscape, and we mulched out the grass, meaning we laid down cardboard or paper or carpet to kill the grass and remove it as a competitor for our garden plants. We dug out pathways that were on contour so that we could capture water sheeting across the more or less level landscape, but moving, and soak it into the ground. And so that we could take that topsoil from the paths, put it onto the raised beds or the beds that we raised, and therefore concentrate the resource that would grow the plants best, not walk on those areas, and then began cultivating. We put in perennials that we brought with us and more that we propagated or bought.
Let's go back to these pictures. So one of the most striking ones is this one here. So we've got a roof structure with solar panels and then greenery, lots and lots of greenery. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on. Did your neighbors have a problem living next to this?
No, none of our neighbors. Our neighbors have been enthusiastic from the beginning. Our nearest neighbors to the north stuck their heads over the fence a few weeks after we arrived in 2006 and said, "Gardeners, woohoo!" Well, I think they had recently bought that property and they were afraid they'd get, a party house, but they got something that they're entirely enthusiastic about. And so it's been. We've had good relations with our neighbors on all sides.
That's lucky.
And up and down the street. And this is an interesting twist, too, because when we arrived, there weren't any gardeners in the neighborhood when we arrived in 2006, 7 years ago. One woman had a few fruit trees in her yard, and she's still there, and she still tends them. Since then, I think we're up to 3 flocks of poultry and another 2 beekeepers besides ourselves. Someone's got turkeys and rabbits in the front yard. Our neighbors, who have a large remnant farm, began rotating cattle on it again after they had not. I think we deserve a little credit for setting a good example. And so something – what you pointed to in the photograph is our first front yard example was putting ourselves out there and showing to everybody who came in into the neighborhood, this is what's going on. The county thinks that we are a residential estate. That's what all these properties are zoned. And that means you can live there and you can grow crops and have pastured animals. So we're simply fulfilling the zoning. And we're inspiring other people to do the same thing. So we're trying to show a way in which, with permaculture, the design system enables us to do less work and have higher yields. People are continuously drawn to what we've created. That chaos you described is, in fact, orderly patterning of nature, adapted to human purposes. It just doesn't look like a lawn. A lawn is actually controlled disorder. You have to work at it all the time. The lawn goes along with the lawnmower, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a chance to gouge your foot or knock out an eye and pollute the atmosphere and disturb the peace and look like a fool wrestling around with this device every Saturday of your life. How crazy is that?
Well, this has been such a pleasure. Thanks.
It's been my pleasure, Annie. Thank you so much.
Peter Bain is the author of the Permaculture Handbook, Garden Farming for Town and Country. More info at permaculturehandbook.com. The first step Peter Bain took to transform his land, as he said, was to mulch out the grass, that controlled disorder, he called it. So how did he do it? Sheet mulching. The guys of Bread and Roses Gardens show us how it's done in the second half of the show. Then we check back with Chef Bob Atkins.
Almost forgot the most important part.
And he grabs his bottle of Budweiser.
I do grab the bottle of Budweiser. Cheap beer. It gives a little bit of yeastiness to it.
This is the last step before he puts the lamb ribs in the oven for a couple hours. Before that, he walks us through his adobo rub. That's coming up. production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Permaculture promises less work for higher yields, which any gardener will say sounds pretty good, but it does require significant work up front, like sheet mulching. Jonas Carpenter of Bread and Roses Gardens explains the basics as Salem Willard gets the materials ready.
You use biomass or carbon materials like cardboard, newspaper, leaf materials like in the tropics they would use banana leaves, and then the use of lots of wood chips, grass clippings, leaves, things like that, essentially to kind of snuff the grass out.
Today, the guys are doing some sheet mulching, not to get rid of grass, but just to prepare the soil to be planted. They're transforming one of the slopes on the property into raised garden beds.
So up here, we're starting a new terrace. We're kind of working up the hillside slowly. In this case, we're planting goji berries, which is also known as wolfberry. Very desirable product because the berries have a lot of essential amino acids, high in beta carotene, and they cost a lot at market. No one can grow them locally, so we're doing it though. I mean, we found that they pretty much grow just like a blackberry would.
Well, you're standing on a pizza box and some junk mail. What on earth does this have to do with a garden?
Well, this is the sheet mulch. This is what we'll be using to block out weeds, block out grass from coming back in the short term. In the long term, the living ground covers, the living mulch basically, will be in place, and that will prevent new weeds from going up.
So literally you just put this, the paper and the cardboard down, and it...
Yeah, so right now Jonas is putting a goji in the ground here, and what we're going to do is add a layer of sheet mulch around the plant to provide a little buffer zone to keep other weeds from going back and in that space.
And, you know, most any paper, will biodegrade. I mean, the shiny stuff, the, like, regular newspaper. Cardboard is the best because it's thick.
Don't forget one casting.
Oh, yep, some castings there.
One final step. These are just wood chips?
Yeah, we're gonna cover the entire bed heavily. The first time we go through, we're gonna put down somewhere around 4 inches of mulch as an average. And the reason we use wood mulch is because it's highly beneficial for fungal activity in the soil. So our fungus friends, they kind of act as the internet of the soil. They spread information, being nutrient and disease. You know, there's something's going around in the forest. That's how the forest works.
Well, that's making me think of morels. You guys going to get some morels around here, you think?
Yeah. Definitely.
More than likely. And doing this kind of work, I've seen many gardens that use this type of mulching in town and suburban areas that find morels.
Ah, wouldn't that be cool? Speaking of which, we're approaching foraging season, aren't we? Ramps and morels soon will be popping up. We offer tips for collecting wild edibles at eartheats.org.
I think it only takes really one time of having a nicely prepared half rack of lamb ribs. That's going to change, and you're going to say, wow, I didn't know that ribs could be that deep. Didn't know they could have that complexity to them and the flavors.
Chef Bob Atkins, back with him in his kitchen at the Rail. Here's the part where he develops those deep, complex flavors for the adobo roasted lamb ribs, which is where his beloved Vitamix comes in. So first order of business, what was that?
That was one 11-ounce can of chipotle peppers and adobo. So that I'm going to add a half cup of fish sauce.
Is it weird that you're putting fish sauce on lamb? Fish plus meat?
I think it's a beautiful thing. Surf and turf.
Fair enough.
And I have a cup of brown sugar. Just a little bit more depth than regular sugar. It's got that molasses kind of bitter note to it.
And then you finish that off with what, like 8 cloves of garlic?
There was 8 or 10 cloves of garlic, depending on, you know, how many, how big they are. But yeah, about 8 or 10 cloves of garlic. Just really quickly going to puree this. Just going to bring it together. This is just a rub. We got heat and sour and sweet and salty. All of that going on right there. So really quickly, I'm just going to pulse this. Let the beauty of the 2.5 horsepower motor do its work. So now I'm going to take the rub that we just blended together, and I'm going to just pour. And now I'm just kind of patting this in, rubbing it on like you do with a rub. Then you know your rack of lamb here.
This is a real hands-on dish.
It is. Great food is hands-on. Getting to know your food, not just in a mental sense or where it came from, but also feeling it and touching it, and makes you more in tune. So into the oven. 325 degrees in a regular oven. Almost forgot the most important part.
And he grabs his bottle of Budweiser.
I do grab the bottle of Budweiser. Cheap beer. It gives a little bit of yeastiness to it. So I'm just going to pour this beer onto the sheet tray. And this is where that extra moisture comes in that we were talking about a minute ago. Where if you didn't add this, the only moisture in the oven would be from the evaporating moisture from the lamb meat itself. After an hour, we're going to check again. And if all that moisture is evaporated, we can add a little bit more beer, a little water. You could use white wine, really anything that you wanted to. You could even use some orange juice or lime juice mixed with that. So we are, in effect, steaming and roasting at the same time.
It was pretty cool to watch Chef Bob Adkins in action. He's the executive chef at The Rail. They change the menu there so often to stay true to the seasons that these adobo-roasted lamb ribs are now no longer available. But who needs to go out when you can make this dish at home yourself? The recipe, along with photos, at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Bob Adkins, Peter Bain, Eabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Jonas Carpenter, Tara Cobb, Lauren Glappa, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Salem Willard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for listening this week. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.